This one is called Mirror, Mirror on the Wall, Do Images Create Reality? And I'm going to say something about feminism just a little to start with, because I wish I knew your name.
Roy Allen.
Because Roy Allen asked me to yesterday over the dinner table. So yesterday I said about feminism that all I was going to define it as a feminist was a stout champion of the rights of women. And I thought that was sufficiently inclusive and also sort of indefinite, so that we didn't have to quarrel about it. A stout champion of the rights of women. I've got some additional sentences about it here, written by a black woman called Barbara Smith. Feminism is the political theory and practice to free all women, women of color, working class women, poor women, physically challenged women, lesbians, old women, as well as white, economically privileged, heterosexual women. Anything less than this is not feminism, but merely female self-aggrandizement. So I just put that in there so that Roy could bring up a question about feminism later. And maybe for some clarity. Today, more on the working papers, and the reason for them being referred to in that way is that I don't think any of us ever get to the answer. We don't get to a final place where it's all clear and where we're done learning and growing and struggling and becoming and trying to get this thing sorted out. So I always think of all of our lives as being in process. And I'm grateful for that. I think it's probably be pretty boring to get it all sorted out in the end. So I'm real open to give and take and disagreement, and these things are not things that I understand in any very permanent way, but they're things that I've been struggling with as I try to invent my life for the last 20 years, and a number of people that I read and a number of people who are friends of mine are in the struggle, and we share it together. And I think sharing together at Holden is a gift. That's being able to bring in a Christian perspective on our struggles to make our lives responsive to our needs and to the needs of the world is a gift that we just can't pass up. It's a wonderful opportunity. Again, as I did yesterday, I want to say that the personal is political. It's an old phrase, sort of hackneyed from from 20 years ago. But so many of the issues, especially I think for women, are personal at the same time as they are political. And if we just say, well, they're personal and therefore not to see the light of day in a public sense, I think it's a great loss to us all, and it will hobble us in our efforts to live productively. Today's an attempt to get at a problem that we all face, but I think women face unsuccessfully in higher numbers than men, probably. And perhaps thinking about it all together can be freeing in some kind of way. I don't have any answers, unfortunately, but I think it's sort of fun to think about it. And it is the problem of perception. It's how we perceive ourselves, it's how others perceive us, it's how the society teaches us to perceive ourselves. And I think that the perceptions that I'm referring to are the ones that undo us, the ones that challenge us in ways that cause us to disintegrate, to fall apart, to not triumph, to not follow the biblical imperative to fulfill ourselves, to bloom, to flower. It's the perception that I think it's those kinds of perceptions that are crippling to us sometimes in our lives that I want to look at. We sometimes find that we're in a situation, a performance situation, having to perform as a mother or as a person on the job or as a person in civic affairs, and we are near someone or in a set situation where we don't do so well. And it's maybe even that someone walks into the room that we feel does not regard us very highly, and we crumble. We stammer and stutter and get less competent. It happens to me when I'm driving. I'll be driving along with a passenger, and the passenger thinks I'm terrific. And I drive very competently, and in Chicago, downtown Chicago, heavy-duty traffic and all that. And then I sometimes have a passenger who I feel intimidated by, and I miss stoplights. I just fall apart. I'm no good at it as a driver. This spring, my children go to a school in Chicago, private school that's for four-year-olds through high school. It's a fairly large place, but it's mostly wealthy people at it, and we are not wealthy. We're teachers, we're middle-class sort of people, and I've always felt slightly intimidated by the wealth in this school. There's lots of parental involvement, and I've always felt that the other parents who are involved there are certainly better at it than I am. And then this spring I got a phone call asking me, a phone call from someone there that I respect a lot, asking me if I would run for the Board of Trustees. And the next day I walked onto the campus, I'm sure standing up straighter, and certainly feeling so powerful there, so efficacious, so good about myself, that I think it changed the way I interacted there, the way I interacted with teachers, with administrators, with children. I felt better and more powerful. I see people nodding. That's the kind of thing I want to talk about today. It's that experience. It's terrifying when it happens, and you just hate it. You just hate yourself for letting it affect you, your environment, the people around you, the place you are. But for some reason, it does. So let's talk about that some, and then let's talk about things we can do in response to that. The primary way I want to talk about that today is through poetry. Women, and I've noticed in my search for this kind of poetry, particularly women of color, express themselves on this subject well in art form, in poetry. Maybe because it's hard to talk about, flat out. Maybe because women see themselves as others see them more. They say that black people see themselves in a society much more objectively, or they see themselves as, they know how white people see them, and they also know how they see each other. So they're aware of two levels or two different kinds of perception about themselves. And I think it's that kind of stepping out of yourself and looking from a distance that maybe makes for good poetry sometimes. So I've found a lot of poetry on this subject, and I'm going to just read some of it, short, accessible poems, and talk about it that way. I started out with these three categories in my search through poetry. I started out with looking for poems where women talked about how they perceived themselves and how they had so much internalized, perhaps, negative views of themselves from society, viewing themselves as the little woman or as being incompetent in finance, or any negative view that they might have picked up from society, or positive, but something where they were objective enough about it that they could write about it in a poem. And then I looked into women writing poetry about interaction with specific other people or places, and then about the effect of society, whatever that means, this North American, United States of America country we live in, and how that affected how they lived their lives, how they felt about themselves. I found the first category to be fairly empty. I couldn't find much. I searched and I read and I would try to force things out of the second category into the first category because I wanted to have some nice things to read in there. And I found that, at least in the books I was looking in, it was a fairly difficult to fill category. I think maybe I found one thing I felt I could use. Yes. At least one thing. It's a poem by Marge Piercy called Barbie Doll. But this poem does move between the first and second categories. I see that. This girl child was born as usual and presented dolls that did pee-pee and miniature GE stoves and irons and wee lipsticks the color of cherry candy. Then, in the magic of puberty, a classmate said, "You have a great big nose and fat legs." She was healthy, tested intelligent, possessed strong arms and back, abundant sexual drive and manual dexterity. She went to and fro apologizing. Everyone saw a fat nose on thick legs. She was advised to play coy, exhorted to come on hearty, exercise, diet, smile, and wheedle. Her good nature wore out like a fan belt. So she cut off her nose and her legs and offered them up. In the casket, displayed on satin, she lay with the undertaker's cosmetics painted on, a turned-up putty nose. Dressed in pink and white nightie, doesn't she look pretty, everyone said. Consummation at last, to every woman a happy ending. But you see what it did? She internalized what had been told to her. And then suddenly the fun, the joy, the intelligence, the good humor went, and she became a big nose and fat legs. So I gave up, and I think I'll give up now on that category and go on to the next. But see, it's that category that's the sticklier. That's the one that hurts us the most, I think, is when we take into ourselves such negative views that we can't maintain against any negative eddies around us. The second category, seeing the effect of some specific place or person on us. An Alice Walker, a black poet and story writer, called I Love the Way Janie Crawford. I love the way Janie Crawford left her husbands, the one who wanted to change her into a mule, and the other who tried to interest her in being a queen. A woman, unless she submits, is neither a mule nor a queen, though like a mule she may suffer, and like a queen pace the floor. She did triumph, though, in the sense that she left him, both of them, which was preferable to assuming that image and becoming that thing. There's another one that I want to read, which is an excerpt from a story, short excerpt from Willa Cather's story, The Wagner Matinee. It's a story of a farm woman from Nebraska who had lived before her marriage in a town where she had studied music and gone to college and become a musician, and then had fallen in love with this man and gone to live on and started a farm, started living in a cave on a hillside, and had a very difficult life, and had lived there 40 years and then got an opportunity to leave. She had to go to New York, I think for some business reason, and she saw her nephew there and stayed with her nephew. And her nephew was someone that she had schooled in music. She taught piano to when he was a child back on the farm. And he took her to a Wagner matinee, a matinee of an orchestra playing Wagner music. This is the end of the story. The second half of the program consisted of four numbers from The Ring and closed with Siegfried's funeral march. My aunt wept quietly, but almost continuously, as a shallow vessel overflows in a rainstorm. From time to time, her dim eyes looked up at the lights burning softly under their dull glass globes. The deluge of sound poured on and on. I never knew what she found in the shining current of it. I never knew how far it bore her, or past what happy islands. From the trembling of her face, I could well believe that before the last number, she had been carried out where the myriad graves are, into the gray, nameless burying ground of the sea, or into some world of death vaster yet, where, from the beginning of the world, hope has lain down with hope, and dream with dream, and renouncing, slept. The concert was over. The people filed out of the hall, chattering and laughing, glad to relax and find the living level again. but my kinswoman made no effort to rise. The harpist slipped the green felt cover over his instrument. The flute players shook the water from their mouthpieces. The men of the orchestra went out one by one, leaving the stage to the chairs and music stands, empty as a winter cornfield. I spoke to my aunt. She burst into tears and sobbed pleadingly. "I don't want to go, Clark. I don't want to go." I understood. For her, just outside the concert hall, lay the black pond with the cattle-tracked bluffs, the tall, unpainted house with weather-curled boards, naked as a tower. The crook-backed ash seedlings where the dishcloths hung to dry. The gaunt, molting turkeys picking up refuse around the kitchen door. Oh, your heart just aches for that woman. You want her to have access to music in her life. It's damaged her that she didn't. It's damaged her because he calls her a shallow dish when she cries. She's been damaged so that the rest of the people weren't crying, the people who could go to music all the time, the people who were professional musicians. But she somehow was called a shallow dish. And she was transported to places of hopelessness and death by the music, because she knew that this day was a marking place in her life, and that for the rest of her life she would be with the molting turkeys outside her door. I find it sad, and I wish that she could change her life, but I don't see any sign in this text that she will. But you see, each of us has made our choice, of course, about our path in life, but you see in her choice to go and live in this place in Nebraska, so much negative here. I mean, there must have been positive things, but the negative is so clear here of having that talent in her die and that love of music in her not be fed. The third negative set of things to look at is the image of the society that the society assigns to women. And there's a poem here, which I'm not going to read all of, but which is called The Tired Poem, Last Letter from a Typical Unemployed Black Professional Woman by Donna Kate Russian. Notice that it's called The Last Letter, and it never tells you in the poem why it is called The Last Letter. But she's a typical, unemployed, black, professional woman. I'm just going to read you the first 20 lines or so. "So it's a gorgeous afternoon in the park. It's so nice, you forget your attitude, the one your mama taught you, the one that says, 'Don't mess with me.' So there, it's, if she had remembered her attitude, she would have kept her armor up and people would have stayed away. You forget until you hear all this whistling and lip smacking. You whip around and say, 'I ain't no damn dog.'" Professional woman saying, "I ain't no damn dog," probably doing it because she wanted to get the effect across fast. She didn't say, "I beg your pardon, young man." She wanted to punch. "It's a young guy. His mouth drops open. 'Excuse me, sister. How you doing?' You lie and smile and say, 'I'm doing good. Everything's cool, brother.' Then 5 minutes later, 'Hey, you sweet devil. Hey, girl, come here.' You tense, sigh, calculate. You know the lean boys and bearded men are only cousins and lovers and friends. Sometimes when you say, 'Hey,' you surprise them. You get a beautiful surprised smile or a good talk." It goes on quite a long time about this woman's experience in the park and then where it takes her in her mind, unable to get a job. But just that choosing that she's doing in those first lines about how she's going to present herself and therefore the kind of stuff that she's getting in from people in the park and the choices she makes even about how to respond. You can respond angry and get one set of things. You can respond cool, communicate, sigh, and make the choice to say, okay, I'm not going to, this guy's just like my brother or my cousin. Or, you know, I'm not going to knock back at him. I'm going to be cool about it. I'm going to be open and pleasant. But it's a choice, and it takes a toll. It costs something to make that choice. That's society. I mean, women who walked on the street in most cities, and I imagine a lot of towns, know what that's like. That happens too. Go past. I had a fun time once. I was teaching a class in a place that was having construction right outside of it, and we had to walk by every day, and they were doing this construction. And finally, one day, I stopped and said, "Do you honestly think that I want to go to bed with you?" And these guys, you know, sweet guys, they could have been my brother. They sort of stammered and stopped and looked and, "No, ma'am." And I said, "Why? What is there about me that makes you think I want to do that? Is it the way I'm dressed? I'm a teacher. I'm dressed like a teacher. I'm a regular person. My students come by here and you do this to them. Every day they come in and tell stories about how sad and upset they are because of what you're doing to us." And these guys were just blushing and stammering and foot in the sand and apologizing. And from then on, we walked by every day and their backs were turned and they were shoveling away. You know. But you don't always have the discretion to do that. But you do know that experience, I'm sure. Another one in that. And this one really gets to me because I'm guilty. It's called, "And When You Leave, Take Your Pictures With You," by a woman called Jo Carrillo. Our white sisters, radical friends, love to own pictures of us, sitting at a factory machine, wielding a machete, in our bright bandanas, holding brown, yellow, black, red children, reading books from literacy campaigns, holding machine guns or bayonets, bombs, knives. Our white sisters, radical friends, should think again. Our white sisters, radical friends, love to own pictures of us, walking to the fields in hot sun with straw hat on head, if brown, bandana, if black, in bright embroidered shirts, holding brown, yellow, black, red children, reading books from literacy campaigns, smiling. Our white sisters, radical friends, should think again. No one smiles at the beginning of a day spent digging for souvenir chunks of uranium or cleaning up after our white sisters' radical friends. And when our white sisters' radical friends see us in the flesh, not as a picture they own, they're not quite as sure if they like us as much. We're not as happy as we look on their wall. So there again, we sort of like the image of people of color in literacy campaigns reading books or looking beautiful in the fields, or, you know, it's easy to manage our feelings about that. But a real angry person in confrontation with me not being pretty and I'm on my wall, there my image has to do some thinking about itself, and I have to check out my expectations for other people, because it's an experience that rings true, I think. But again, that's society saying this is how you manage your feelings about people of color who are poorer than you. Don't they look lovely? Don't they have pretty environments? Aren't they nice to look at in pictures? So their lives must be okay and I don't have to feel guilty and worried about their being poorer than me. Or less powerful than I am in some way. So those are some negative views. Then I think we can turn a corner understanding that and say, how do we grow out of this? How do we reclaim our images? How do we become more efficacious in the face of people around us who don't believe we're powerful or good, or who don't believe we're competent? people who turn us down for work because we're women and they don't think women can do whatever kind of work it is, or ways in which we cut ourselves off at the knees because we don't believe we can handle whatever it is, ways in which we don't volunteer to do stuff in civic affairs, we don't volunteer to take responsibility, or ways in which at work we don't offer to write up the piece that needs to be written because we don't think we can write as well as somebody else, or, you know, ways in which we cut ourselves off too. It's, we internalize these views. I think I'll read a couple poems and then I'll talk about some ideas maybe within the poems. One thing I do, though, which I think might be helpful to mention, is that when I feel that I'm in danger, I live in Chicago, and sometimes I have to come home from meetings at night, and I sometimes feel that I'm in danger. And I get myself into a frame of mind that says that I am just coming off the second shift of waiting tables in some greasy spoon, and I'm going home to squalling, sick, difficult children and a dirty house, and I have had it up to here. And then I storm along down the street, so angry, so tired, so overworked, that nobody wants to mess with me. I mean, they might have had me picked out as someone that might have some money, but when they get close and see that attitude that I'm carrying within me, the attitude says, I don't think I want to mess with her. She's not going to be fun to mess with at all, because she looks so fed up with the world. So people back off. And I think that we can choose sometimes to assume a persona like that if we need to convey whatever image it is we need to be, whatever we need to become. I think we have, once we raise this dilemma or this problem to consciousness, we have a little bit of choice over how we act and what to do with it. In Homegirls, this poem is called I Used to Think, by a woman called Shirlane McRae. I used to think I can't be a poet. You notice a lot of poetry is, women's poetry in particular, is about how I used to be. And often it's because they've grown through one of these things, they've come to terms with it. I used to think I can't be a poet because a poem is being everything you can be in one moment, speaking with lightning protest, unveiling a fiery intellect, or letting the words drift feather soft into the ears of strangers who will suddenly understand my beautiful and tortured soul. But I've spent my life as a black girl, a nappy-headed, no-haired, fat-lipped, big-bottomed black girl, and the poems will surely come out wrong, like me. I would like to say at this point that the poem has the word nigger in it a couple of times, and I don't like using it. I'm real uncomfortable with it. I don't like saying that, but I'm gonna. And I don't want everyone looking at me. If I could be a cream-colored, lovely, with gypsy curls, someone's pecan dream and sweet sensation, I'd be poetry in motion, without saying a word, and wouldn't have to make sense if I did. If I were beautiful, I could be angry and cute instead of an evil, pouting, mammy bitch, a nigger woman. Passed over, conquested and passed over, a nigger woman to do it to in the bushes. So there the argument is, this is a put in black language and description, but if all of us know the feeling, if I were just beautiful enough, and wonderful enough, I wouldn't have to make sense. I wouldn't have to be smart. I wouldn't have to be capable. My mother tells me I used to run home crying, that I wanted to be light like my sisters. She shook her head and told me there was nothing wrong with my color. She didn't tell me I was pretty, so my head wouldn't swell up. Black girls cannot afford to have illusions of grandeur, not ass-kicking, too loud laughing, mean and loose black girls. And even though in Africa I was mistaken for someone's fine sister or cousin or neighbor down the way, even though I swore never again to walk with my head down, ashamed, never to care that those people who celebrate the popular brand of beauty don't see me, it still matters. Looking for a job, it matters. standing next to my lover when someone light gets that "she ain't nothing, come home with me" expression. It matters. But it's not so bad now. I can laugh about it, trade stories, and write poems about all those put-downs, my rage and hiding. I'm through waiting for minds to change. The 60s didn't put me on a throne. And as many years as I've been black, like ebony, black like the night, I have seen in the mirror of the eyes of my sisters that pretty is the woman in darkness who flowers with loving. So she talks about how she's internalized society's standards for her, and then she talks about how she rose above that and has gotten over that because of love and respect from other people, from her sisters. I think it can be sisters and brothers. But it's well put, I think, that she really has flowered in the face of her own feeling bad about that and accepting society standards for what was acceptable in a woman. Alice Walker, who I keep coming back to because I enjoy so much, has a couple of poems sort of on this theme. One is called On Stripping Bark from Myself, for Jane, who says, "Trees die from it, stripping bark." Because women are expected to keep silent about their close escapes, I will not keep silent. And if I am destroyed, naked tree, someone will please mark the spot where I fall and know I could not live silent in my own lies, hearing their, "How nice she is." No, I am finished with living for what my mother believes, for what my brother and father defend, for what my lover elevates, for what my sister, blushing, denies or rushes to embrace. I find my own small person, a standing self against the world, an equality of wills I finally understand. Besides, my struggle was always against an inner darkness I carry within myself, the only known keys to my death, to unlock life or close it shut forever. A woman who loves wood grains, the color yellow, and the sun. I am happy to fight all outside murderers, as I see I must. And I think the outside murderers that she's happy to fight are all these people telling her how she should be and who she should be. But she's fighting them. She gets above them. She doesn't agree. She doesn't buy into that plan. We can talk later about why. She doesn't really say why. She says it was a close escape for her. She almost did. Another one by Alice Walker called Light Baggage for Zora, Nella, and Jean. Zora Neale Hurston, Nella Larson, and Jean Toomer wrote and published their best work during their 20s and 30s. At some point in their careers, each of them left the career of writing and went off seeking writing's very heart, life itself. Zora went back to her native Florida, where she lived in a one-room cabin and raised her own food. Jean Toomer became a Quaker and country philosopher in Bucks County, Pennsylvania. And Nella Larson, less well known than either Hurston or Toomer, became a nurse. So this poem about them, called Light Baggage. There is a magic lingering after people to whom success is merely personal, who, when the public prepares a feast for their belated acceptance parties, pack it up like light baggage and disappear into the swamps of Florida or go looking for newer gods in the oak tree country of Pennsylvania. Or decide, quite suddenly, to try nursing, midwifery, anonymous among the sick and the poor. Stories about such people tell us little, and if 100 photographs survive, each one will show a different face. Someone out of step, alone out there, absorbed, fishing in the waters of experience, a slouched back against the shoulders of the world. If success is merely personal, then it's not your identity. And then you can choose a different life. You can choose to move because you've got within yourself all the baggage you need. You've got yourself. And so you can choose to go off and do something else. You don't have to depend on the reputation you've built or on society's view of you. So then, if 100 photographs survive, each one will show a different face. The photographs are the images of this person, but you can't catch the person in the image because the person has withdrawn from it, or is more than it, or is separated from it, and carries herself within herself. That one I have a little trouble with, because I like to think that our salvation from this problem is probably in rootedness and in finding loved ones and in finding support groups and in building for ourselves, choosing for ourselves an environment where we grow and thrive. But I understand her point. If you don't have that, but you have all you need within yourself, I couldn't do it. It's not my way, but it is a way, I think. So I guess I would say, and then I want to open it for discussion, that what I would choose would be love and family. And I have, for example, a women's group that's met every other Wednesday night for 16 years, and that's my support group, also my family is. I think we should try to think about putting ourselves in work situations and in home situations and in all kinds of places where we feel power, where we feel rootedness, not where we feel undermined and diminished. And it's one reason why I'm for inclusive language in the church, because I find that I become a smaller, more diminished person in place in worship situations where I'm excluded by the language. I just feel extraneous and irrelevant and unloved. And I don't think I'm alone. I think that when my daughter hears church language that talks about men only, she feels outside of that too. I think that's important. I think this whole thing is important in terms of our thinking about our church. That when I'm in a worship service where I feel included, where the language includes me, where the images of God are not specifically male, or if they are some male, there's some female, or there are other kinds of images of God, I just feel better. So I guess that's the note I'd like to end on and say, did this make sense? What do you think? What are your reactions? Do you have ideas for survival? Did it work to read poetry? There are other poems, but I think it's much more important to talk than to keep reading.
I think the last one we were talking about, the 100 different photographs or whatever it is, I think I look at it a little differently, in that in some ways, in the past when we were so locked into a single position or a single way they could operate, that it's interesting to be able to try, even though you might fail in some directions, that to have the strength or vision to go on into different territories. I guess within my own life, I've tried a number of different things and have felt more successful in some than others, but have felt the freedom and the strength within myself, partly coming from a support base in the fact that my mother was always said, you can be or do whatever you want. I just want to, you know, be happy, but try stuff. And I did, and I guess that's the way, I guess looking back, I probably would have 100 different photographs of who I have been and have become through the various transitions that I've made and choices of what I have wanted to do with my life. And it's given me a chance to explore in a much wider range than it would have if I had been locked into some kind of expectations of somebody else.
Thank you for that. That really rings true. I appreciate you saying that very much. I think that's a very important thought. And even at one time in our lives, we have different ways of being. You know, I can tell My kids can tell when I'm talking on the phone, if I'm doing business or if I'm talking to a friend, you know, our tone of voice and our posture and all of that, if I'm at work or if I'm at home. Other comments or feedback?
I have a cousin with whom I grew up, and we were very close, and we were both very, very pious people. We were raised in the Roman Catholic Church. And I got together with her very recently. She's had a good life. She's got a family. Her husband is a fine man. She's had some problems with alcohol. But she is now, I perceive, a very strong woman. And I was shocked to find that she has left the church after she's a woman of in her 50s. For precisely the same reasons that you cite, Ingrid, she found the Catholic Church, and she would never have dreamed of being anything but a Catholic, I don't think. She certainly didn't sound it. But she found the Catholic Church, probably more than most Protestant churches, to be so male and so putting down of females that having tried to accommodate herself with it over the years, she couldn't take it anymore and she left. I found that very sad, but I could understand it as she explained it to me.
It's a familiar story. I know so many women who have done that. I was out of the church for 15 years, and I still felt it was my church, but that I couldn't go there because it did bad things to me. But that's a sad story, but not an uncommon one. She could go and find the Mary Knowles if she really wanted to. There's some wonderful Catholic women, but it's a terrible thing. I wonder if you have ideas about ways of confronting people or work situations that do this to you. I think we can. I think we can say it to our loved ones and work through it. I don't think we have to be stuck in a place where there's an old Johnny Mathis song, for those of you who are my age or older, that you might remember the Johnny Mathis song that says, "It's not just for what you are yourself that I love you as I do, but for what I am when I am with you." And it's certainly the case that depending on who we're with, we become more or less of different kinds of people. I think if with a loved one, with a mate, even in a work situation, can you challenge the bad stuff? Does anyone have any experience with that? Yeah.
Yeah, and I found that for me it was once I actually had the confidence to own the feelings.
Yes.
And not feel, somebody made me feel totally inadequate. Instead of leaving that place feeling so inadequate, it was all my fault, and being depressed for 2 days, actually saying, yes, I am, I feel completely inferior, I feel really intimidated by this person, and actually then having the confidence to say to them, what you said there, I find very undermining of me. I know that's me because I've got my problems, but I also found the way you said it very undermining. Is that what you meant? And I found once I had that confidence to say that, that things actually got much, and I could confront them.
And often you didn't even have to be real confrontational, but just communicate.
Yeah, just actually say what I was feeling.
Exactly. Yeah. Report your feelings, and often that's often the other person that feels terrible, but then the two of you can start talking about it at least. Another way is humor. I was in a meeting once where two women and two men from my staff were meeting with a president and an academic dean of Carleton College. And at the end, the president and dean, who were both men, of course, stood up and, well, all through the meeting that had been going on, that when I would say something, the men would look at the men, and if our men nodded at their men, then they would assume it was true. Or if it would get restated by one of our men, then their men would think it was true. And at the end of it, we all stood up, the meeting was over, and the men all shook hands. So my friend Vivian and I shook hands, and the men sort of looked at us like, why are those two women shaking hands with each other? And then we just laughed. And it really communicated something, that little scene. You know, it just changed, it shifted something so that we didn't have to get mad at each other, but a point had been made. I think humor is another way of doing it. I think often just plain explaining your feelings is real powerful. And the more you can do that, especially with loved ones, the more you can build something good, and you don't have to be at loggerheads. You can just communicate. I've seen couples here where the man is extremely solicitous of the woman, climbing or walking out or going up to Copper Falls or something. And I worry. I think, is there something wrong? I mean, no, if I inquire sometimes, I'm sorry to see that you have a health problem. And of course she doesn't. She's fine. But there's something weakening about that experience. She feels less confident. She thinks, well, maybe I can't handle this climb, or I can't do it, it's another example of the way you start to believe other people's messages about you. And it doesn't do you any good sometimes. Another thing we can do is just real consciously. On my staff, we're half women and half men. And we do very consciously say supportive things to each other. Like, my, that was a good point. Just as it's been ignored or restated by one of the men or something. Well, that was a good point, Pat. Good for you. And it, you know, just watching for it in a work situation has made it possible to deal with and brought us back into some kind of reasonable understanding of each other's talents and skills. Other comments or feedback? Questions? Yes.
I think it went through a really interesting experience in the last year. I think as a writer, I accepted always within the writing community as to what I write, not my sexuality. It's basically, if I'm a good writer, you're accepting. But I was asked to write a film on sexual harassment for the city of Edmonton. And it was a very interesting experience talking to women who have been sexually harassed and finding their stories and finding how fearful, full of fear they were to even bring it out, or helplessness they felt in what to do with it. And so the producer and I and the people that were involved structured it as three women telling their story. They were actresses, but we used an amalgamation of the real stories. And it became a very powerful vehicle, and it has, I guess, we used some humor in it as well, and how these women dealt with it in three different ways. One who basically transferred because she couldn't handle it. Another who went and reported it, and I won't go into details. And at the end, had the mayor basically give a message saying, we will not put up with sexual harassment at City Hall. If you have any problems in this area, please contact these people and be dealt with. Within the last year, they've had three dismissals, and we have two lawsuits going through court dealing with sexual harassment. For some reason, that empowered by simply a 12-minute video empowered people to come forward, or before they didn't. And I guess it's the women, those of us who are in situations that can empower others, I think it's very important for us to do that in whatever way we can, to give people permission to take control of their lives again.
Thank you. That's really a good example. And I think it shows us the power of imagery, of just providing a language and images for our experience. And that enables us to own it and to take control of it in a new way. Just being given those images, that 12-minute video, and given the language to talk about that, given the kind of legitimacy that thing had been put out and was paid for and produced and enabled women to free themselves from some of that.
I guess one of the interesting things that came out of it is that there were men that did not understand what it was and didn't know what sexual harassment was. And so part of that came out when we defined within the program. It was sort of like very interesting to some of them because some had realized that is what they had been doing.
Consciousness raising.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's helpful for everybody to, when there's something like that going on in a society, to provide some images and language to talk about it. Yes, did you have something you wanted to say?
Well, I was just saying in the matter of humor, even the cartoon strips pick it up. Are you familiar with Sally Fuller? It's a normalist cartoon about a two vocation family with one child. And for a while they were running this long discussion about how to divide the work at home and what all that meant. And I'm sure people who are in the situation of a child with a family and both parents working, this child is not a little child, it's probably 8 or 10, big enough to make smart answers, could really identify with some of the situations they raise.
Mm-hmm.
They're very ordinary, but and she has the problem of of unconscious harassment at work too. And at the moment I can't think of a specific to cite for you, but it's in a lot of the major newspapers.
Mm-hmm.
And sounds
like fun.
Pretty soon will be out in the cartoon books like Newsberry.
Good. The Sylvia cartoon is another one that does that well. I wonder if men have any reactions or problems with what I've said. Do you want to get back to your question about feminism? Okay. Fine. Someone up there? Yeah.
I had an experience of being sexually harassed. And it's a devastating experience. But I think that as a woman, I have responsibility to other women to confront the person who harassed me so that this will not happen to other people.
Mm-hmm.
It's an extremely difficult thing to confront someone who has harassed you because they will usually deny it. They will try to manipulate the situation so that you are the person who is at fault.
Mm-hmm.
It is really difficult, but I must say that my husband was a real gem because he went along with me when I confronted this person.
Mm.
And it was amazing. But I really felt good about myself for having the courage to confront him. And also I knew that this might make him think twice before he did harass someone else.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's wonderful. Good for you and good for your husband. That's a terribly important thing to do, and it's at the time when you feel least able to do it.
Mm-hmm.
You feel very vulnerable when something like that's happened to you. And you don't really have a lot of power and strength at that point.
I was very angry, and the person that I went to get some counseling about the situation, I said, well, I think maybe I have let go of my anger, and maybe I've even forgiven the person. And the counselor said to me, don't give up the anger. You need that anger when you go in to confront this person.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think, is very wise counsel.
Yeah, sounds like it. Well, good for you. Thank you. Yes.
There's a book over in the bookstore called Caring Enough to Confront. Mm-hmm. And it's written very simply, but there's some really helpful things in that book that are helpful if you want to learn to confront. And it makes it seem like something that's very possible and a real alternative and a way of personally, a way of keeping your personal integrity and expressing whatever it is you need
to express in a way that is not hurtful, you know, to the other person. I mean, maybe in some situations that can't even be a matter of concern, but in personal relationships and so forth. And I found it very helpful, and I've recommended it to other people who have also found it a good resource.
Hmm. Good. Well, bear that in mind. Is it good for interpersonal, in personal relationships?
Very good. That's the place where it's probably the best for interpersonal relations. It's been a while since I've really looked at it, but I think there's even ways to confront on the job and with, you know, various ways that are done in them. It has a somewhat of a Christian, there is some Christian orientation to it. It's been useful to a lot of people.
Good. Well, bear that in mind. What's the name of the book?
Caring Enough to Confront.
It's
very good. Very practical. It is. It's simple, but it's helpful. You know, it's not simplistic, really. It's simple, but helpful.
Thank you.
I was really struck by the poem about the girl who was told that she had a big nose and fat legs.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it's a question and then some solutions. But I think for adults, maybe in a lot of cases, we've had enough time to have people be mirrors for us in positive ways, so that when I run up against, you know, somebody who says things or does things that really undermine me, I have, you know, I can refer back to a lot of other positive situations. But for an adolescent, it seems sometimes they don't have that, and like that one comment just devastated her.
Mm-hmm.
And I really ache for those kids, and I think, number one, a lot of times we don't know, you know, what image they're carrying with them that just overshadows everything else that they're doing. That really frustrates me, because sometimes you find it out and sometimes you don't. And I don't really know all the things you can do about that with adolescents, but I think that it is really important for us to tell them not to try to force them to be what we think they should be, but when we see beauty in them, in the things that they do and in the way that they are and how they look, I think it's really important to tell them. So I've tried to make a conscious effort to do that, and as much as I can to encourage people around me to tell them. And sometimes with teenagers, I think people are a little bit afraid to approach them, maybe not if they have their own, but you know, sometimes it's like you kind of don't know what to say, or you're afraid that they will smart back, or you just don't know what they're going to do. But I think it's really important just to tell them, you know, when they've done something really neat, and little things too. But at the same time, you know, I know that that's really important, but also it's a question for me too, you know, what else can be done to help those kids.
Certainly interrupting bad stuff that's going on, I think, is something we should all get better at doing.
I think as Christians it's very important, and I do the counseling too, what does God say about you? I think that's where the verse comes from, and for me it has been, I mean, I can say, so what, if you say that I know God loves me, and finding passages like you're precious in my eye, or the apple of my eye, or something, this imagery that they can relate to, and I have them pick it up themselves, what speaks to you. Or another way is you find yourself in one of the New Testament where Jesus is something, identify one of the persons and use that as like therapy, that's very helpful. And then bring Jesus into, you know, whoever you, and there's usually one person you can identify with. And then bring Jesus into the situation. And memorizing this, even if you have to say it first and write it down and have it in your mirror, it might seem, you know, unproductive, but it really ministers to the spirit and they get the message. Or when they're afraid, fear not, I have to pick out a passage, they say there are 365, fear not, from the Bible before. And the sort of children, like, run through fear of death and so forth. And I did that, and he came and he was not afraid of death because the word peace and the spirit of resurrection.
Well, thank you very much. Appreciate the feedback.